is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Happy Wednesday and good evening, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. This is a call-in show. You can feel free to call in with any questions. There is no stupid question. Our telephone lines are 323-6232 and 325-4316, 325-4259. In the house today, we have a wonderful co-host in the form of Dr. Devon Curling, who is a internist, a hematologist, and a medical oncologist, a Bahamian one at that. Good evening and welcome, Devon.
Good evening, Bahamas.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Which island did you grow up? Where did you go to primary school, high school? Where did you go to university? How long have you been back? Tell us about your family.
All right, well, my last name is Curling, as you know, so that's a proud Ragged Island name. Born and raised in Nassau. Went to school at St. Andrews. After finishing St. Andrews, I went to COB, not UB, so that should tell you something about my age. After that, I did my undergraduate studies at Hampton University in Virginia. I then did medical school at Temple University in Philadelphia. And after that, I did my fellowship in hematology and oncology and also my internal medicine at Robert Wood Johnson Hospital in New Jersey. The day after I was done, I was on the first thing screaming back home because I knew that this is where I wanted to be. That was in 2004, and I've been practicing at home in the public and private sector since that time.
And how has it been as a whole since you've been back? Was it difficult transitioning? Were there a lot of obstacles? Were there a lot of frustrations? Did you ever regret coming back?
I think people who want to come back never actually regret it. This is where I knew I wanted to be. Now, that being said, I had never done any of my training at the Princess Margaret Hospital. So walking into Princess Margaret was a bit of a shock because I came from a system where every patient had their own bed, their own room. It was rare to have two patients in a room. So to walk in and be on an open ward for the first time with 16 or 20 patients in one room was a bit of a shocker. Obviously, when you're training in the U.S., there are certain things that are available at the drop of a dime. If I ordered an MRI, it was done that day. If I ordered any blood test, it was done that day. Any medication I wanted or needed was easily there and accessible, whereas we're dealing with a resource-restricted environment. So making that adjustment, it actually in some ways teaches you to be a better physician because there's many times when you have to improvise. And to be able to improvise, you have to know the basics and understand why you're doing something. So the transition is interesting, but as I said, it never was something where I was to the point of frustration where I wanted to leave.
And you mentioned MRI. That's one of the bigger frustrations for me. The cornerstone of screening for prostate cancer, which is the number one cancer in this country as a urologist, is having an available MRI. I cannot for the life of me understand why in the government system, despite petitions by everybody involved, it's needed by vascular surgeons, it's needed for cardiovascular surgeons, definitely neurosurgeons, neurology, everyone, trauma, and strokes, you need to have an MRI on the premises that you can easily access at all times of the night. It makes no point or any sense somebody unstable being taken in an ambulance, intubated to a private facility to get an MRI, because that is the gold standard. So why are we accepting suboptimal care in so many specialties because we don't have an MRI? MRI is not exceedingly expensive. There, on this 21x7 Mile Island, we have 5 private MRIs that I know about. And it's not difficult to maintain them. It's not difficult to service them. It provides such invaluable information in terms of screening and in terms of life-saving measures, in terms of diagnosis. Why does the government not have an MRI available?
So, Dr. Pinter, you're preaching to the choir here. I mean, that is a question, as you know, because in oncology, it's something that we need also. It has place. There are certain times when we actually need the MRI to determine what the treatment is that we're going to do. And I just think that the public healthcare funds are being stretched in so many different ways, and we're constantly running after something. So trying to plan ahead for the future and say, okay, in the next 5 years, we're going to have this MRI, that. It's kind of hard to do that when you're on the ground trying to fix things that need immediate, urgent fixing right there and then. That's the best explanation that I can come up with, because it is something that I agree we've been crying and screaming for ages.
I mean, just in terms of the human toll it takes because we don't have an MRI, well, let's talk away the finances, even if we just put it into dollars and cents. If we had MRI, the healthcare system as a whole will save a whole lot of money just in terms of screening, picking up cancers early, directing persons to immediate treatment and management before it advances to a cancer, I mean, that might take $10,000 a month to keep somebody alive.
Right. And I mean, the saving goes beyond that. I mean, the savings also
saving of lives, saving of years of someone's life, saving of someone's life that they could have potentially lived another 30 years and they didn't.
Right. And there's also the actual, I think the strongest argument is the actual practical cost, right? The amount of money that is spent through social services going to private facilities will probably more than pay to have an MRI in the system. I think when you look at a resource-restricted environment and the issues and problems that causes in terms of lives being saved, diseases progressing, I could use one oncology patient and show you where the multiple delays just happen all along the tract. So that someone who starts out at a stage one, by the time all of the things that need to be done are done, they've advanced to stage 2, 3, or even 4. And it's because of lack of resources. It's because of machines breaking down, certain blood tests not being available, biopsies being done, but there's manpower shortages in various areas so that the actual diagnosis takes time to come back all the while that patient is sitting there.
I mean, just in terms of being in urology and trying to fight an impossible fight against overwhelming numbers of prostate cancer, where as many as 1 in 6 Bahamians or residents are going to get prostate cancer, and not just prostate cancer, more aggressive form because we're primarily of African ancestry. The gold standard in modern urology is that you need an MRI to determine whether you are going to actually perform biopsies. So we always talk about PSA, prostate-specific antigen blood tests. That's a blood test that's specific to the gland, not to actual prostate cancer. So it can be elevated for so many reasons other than cancer. So 25, 30 years ago, where very few MRIs were available, everyone was getting a biopsy if you have elevated PSA. And they found that about only 30% really required biopsy. So we were unnecessarily doing about 70% of the biopsies that we were previously doing were absolutely unnecessary. And it's not a pleasant experience, particularly in the government system where we can't, because of resources being stretched, offer conscious sedation or general anesthesia. You're going to feel, even if not physically, even that little pinch of doing 12 cores with a ultrasound probe in your back passage, it's a traumatic experience of it that you don't need to put somebody through. And not only that, just in the understanding of prostate cancer itself, it's not a uniform disease. You can have a higher stage pathologically in one part of the gland, and you can completely miss that and pick up a lower stage, and you are treating someone based on that lower stage diagnosis, which is completely incorrect. So in itself, it can be dangerous. So blindly doing biopsies without determining whether they're necessary, then even if they are necessary, if we had MRI, we can do targeted biopsies and get accurate diagnosis, stage someone correctly. And there are many persons that if we can pick them up early, we don't even need to cure them immediately. We can actively surveil them. So that allows a maybe a few years sometimes where we don't have to overwhelm the system. So in so many ways, I think it frustrates me to hear. I'm glad to hear this small island's getting a $53 million project, so $144 million project. Yes, but as a nation where we have the number one cancer, killing many men in their prime, where we have so many persons with non-communicable diseases coming in because of uncontrolled diabetes, hypertension, obstructive sleep apnea, coming in with strokes that require an MRI, where we, if we had that, we can save lives, it's beyond frustrating. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We can talk about this piece of equipment, this drug, this, that. There's so many things that if we actually spent the money, we would save money in the long run. We wouldn't have so many beds occupied by someone with cervical cancer that's stage four, someone with prostate cancer who's in and out of hospital 20 times in 10 years, slowly dialing and taking up a ER space, taking up a medical bed, taking up using very expensive drugs. I don't know what we can do to convince those in charge. And it's, as I say, it's not one minister, it's not one government. Successively, I've asked different government ministers of health to please, and they know better than anyone else for some of them, an MRI is fundamental to the Bahamian healthcare system. But we're saying a little piece there is a little bit of frustration. So coming back, I have spoken with Dr. Francis, and he has a little bit of a nicer spin on it. You, I'm sure, I know from personal experience and knowing you well, you also had a problem, despite your qualifications, being one of the very few qualified Bahamian oncologists, you had to wait many years to be promoted as a consultant. If you had gone anywhere in the world, you would have become a consultant or, in the United States, an attending right away. Don't you think that the system, the way it stands in terms of it being uninviting, that's a nice word of saying it, for specialists to come back, even with fellowships, how can we change the system? How can you tell somebody that they're not a consultant, but yes, you must work as a consultant. You're not going to pay them as a consultant. Even in my own experience, they had me working as a consultant. But for example, when you want to vote for head of department as a consultant, you have no rights because on paper, you're not a consultant. What frustrations did you have in terms of how long did it take you to get promoted? How many years? And what was your experience?
Tell you the truth, I cannot even remember how many years it took. I think I started out as an SHO, and yes, I was fully qualified and so on. This is an antiquated system in many ways. And I think the big issue is how do we convince our physicians that are studying abroad to come back home? In the system that we have right now, I'm sure you know, and most people know, that just about everyone that I know that's training in the U.S. or other places tends to stay. And they stay for myriad reasons. One of them is, if you're a subspecialist in, let's say, invasive cardiology or something like that, in the U.S., you're automatically getting offers, multiple offers, in the mid six figures. Okay, you come home and you are, first of all, not offered a consultant spot. You're told that you have to be a junior and work under people that at times you are more qualified than. And I think that we have to do a better job of identifying what the needs of the country are. So when I was finishing, for instance, nobody had any idea that there was a Bahamian oncologist that was about to finish. There was one other, Dr. Turnquest. They had known about him, but nobody really knew what I was off and doing. And a part of that is because we don't have a coordinated plan. There are some islands that track where every one of their students is. So they know that they have a student in Morocco who's studying this. They know that they have someone in New York who's doing this. And if there's something that is a government project that's coming up, they actually call those people and say, look, we have something for you. We have an opportunity for you to bring you home. And, you know, the flip argument that happens, and sometimes people will say, well, you know, that person's being greedy, they should come back home, it's not about the money, and so on, until it's their child. And I know many people that I speak to have said, no, I'm telling my son, my daughter, stay right where they are because there's nothing here to come back to, and why do you want to deal with this? So,
in particular, if you went to medical school in the United States, you may have hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans that you have to pay.
Right.
And just to break even, it might take years for you to get to that level. And if you're being paid as a senior house officer, just above the level of an intern, and you have not only a qualified consultant degree, plus in many cases, many persons have a fellowship, means they're super specialized. It is beyond insulting intellectually. It's beyond insulting on every level, even as a human being. If you went to Batelco, they wouldn't treat you like that. If you went to BPL, they wouldn't treat you like that.
Not to that extent.
In terms of the years, very few of us go to school as long as we do
right.
in terms of residency and everything else.
Right. But the point where I will disagree with you on is that it's a very famous government statement or public sector statement. You're overqualified. We don't have a space for you here. Maybe in a couple years. Not that we don't need it, but you're overqualified. Now, in medicine, obviously, no one's overqualified. There are some very rare specialties where we just don't have the equipment and so on to be able to do it. So if you're someone who does bone marrow transplants, that's not something that we're going to do here because we don't have the infrastructure to back it up. But for the most part, I agree. I mean, we should be saying we need six urologists. How are we going to go about, as a country, ensuring that we get six people back here so the system's not overwhelmed? So Dr. Pinto isn't sitting here swamped working from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. and just gets burned out. That is where we really have to do the analysis in healthcare to say, these are the projects that we need. But I'll go back to my first example, which is, so with the hospital, for instance, we're building a new hospital. So we're building a new boat. But the boat that we have, we're just trying to patch holes everywhere and it's sinking or just barely staying above water. That problem is still going to be there when the new boat comes out, right? And so we still have not found ways to fix these issues. And the bottom line is it's because of cost.
Very much so. So, I mean, we talked about it the last time you were on. We're talking about brain drain. Trying to get persons to come back and make a difference, to make a change, to improve. We're talking about medicine, but we can expand this to any arena in our society. But if the first thing, if we as ambassadors try to encourage someone to come back, the first thing they're going to ask is, what was your experience? And you have to be forthright and forthcoming and be honest. And if you just start to talk about what you went through, most people say, okay, stop right there, I'm not coming back. How can we change that? How can we stop someone like comes tomorrow from experiencing what we went through 15 years ago or what someone went through 25 years ago? Because it's the same story. I speak to my senior colleagues who came back 30 years ago. What they went through is very much similar to what you went through, what I went through, and nothing's changed. If anything, maybe things have gotten worse. So I'm worried that for our children in 15, 20 years, what are they going to come back to? Maybe they're not going to want to come back because they saw what their fathers went through and the hell that they went through. And where is our country going to be? Where is medicine going to be in terms of the future if that continues to happen?
Well, I think that issue is alive and well right now. It's not our children. It's in the young people that are off in school right now at this very moment who, when they leave at the age of 18 or 19, have already made up in their mind that they're not coming back. When we're looking at healthcare in particular and how we change that, I think this is an antiquated system in the sense of promotions, going from intern to SHO to registrar to senior registrar to a consultant. And we've got to be brave enough to say, when we're in certain positions, if you're qualified and you've completed your training, okay, if I don't have a consultant spot, well, at least I'm going to treat you in that manner, and I'm going to give you all the rights and privileges. Now, there's some complications with that legal-wise and so on. But no one is going to want to train for 15 years or 16 years and then come back and be told, you have to be subordinate to this person because that's how the system is. So we have to be bold enough to say the system is antiquated and broken, and now we have to change it so that we either have physicians in training or we have a consultant. The many things in between, the many machinations in between, it just adds to bureaucracy, and it also clogs the system in terms of responsibilities and so on. So, but that's something that we have to actually say. So on the day that you are finished your training, you're either promoted to a consultant or you're going out into the private sector. But not that I finished my training and now I've got to wait 10 years till there's a consultant spot. So I'm not going to be, I'm qualified, but I don't have the responsibility of my qualifications, and that's going to burn anybody out.
I mean, to put it in perspective, if the audience doesn't really understand the hierarchy of medicine, and it's really a British system, if you're a medical student, you then graduate from medical school, you become an intern. Here, the internship is a year. It used to be many years ago, a year and a half, where you had 6 months of elective. So essentially, someone was a medical student. They did 1 year of internship at Princess Margaret Hospital. Then they become a senior house officer in the area they have gotten into, whether it's obstetrics and gynecology or surgery or pediatrics, internal medicine, etc. But then they get that salary and they act as a senior house officer. To ask somebody who came from abroad who was acting as a consultant in a tertiary academic system where there was a university where you had other, and particularly if you did fellowship, to have somebody, for example, I had other urologists from around the world under me who I trained, where I had my own operating list, where you can say, why do we treat our own so poorly? And then you have somebody who, because of need, you'll have to bring them in, never saw the Bahamas before, where you or I went through every level of being intern, SHO, registrar, senior registrar, born Bahamian, our family is Bahamian, were contributed to our society for generations. We are treated so poorly where we have to wait 5-6 years of begging to become a consultant. Someone reaches the airport, drives straight to Princess Margaret Hospital. They're made a consultant because that's the only way that you can attract someone to accept that job. But yet, because we're Bahamian, and I'm not asking for anyone to be treated better than anyone else, at least we should be treated on par with our foreign counterparts. And it's insulting, for example, for someone like myself, and it's happened, or yourself, someone to come 5 years, 6 years after you, and they just finished. Maybe they didn't even do a fellowship. They just finished their consultant degree, and the next week, they're a consultant senior to you. It boggles my mind. We have a call coming in. This urologist speaks.
There you are.
Good day.
Yes. You know, it amazed me how, right, professionals, right, rather than nurse, right, or any professional, you know, with degrees, with graduate or post-grad, right, they all say that they can't make enough to support their life in the Bahamas, right, but yet they would the society would say that the man who's uneducated, right, and poor, right, should satisfy what they make. They can, whatever you pay them, a minimum wage, that we know is not a livable wage, who studies? You know, please make that make sense to me.
Well, when we talk about this as a global market, when you get qualifications and you make sacrifice, Dr. Curling spoke about 15, 16 years of your life where you're going into debt, you're making next to nothing or making nothing at all. You sacrifice in every aspect of your life. Socially, you're away from your family. You put off doing certain things. You don't own anything. All you do is own debt. And you come back. In many cases, you might have had 5, 6, 8, 10 offers with a certain salary so that you can start to pay down on loans that you are behind in. And maybe after 3, 4 years, maybe you can start from scratch and zero.
To ask somebody
to come back and become an SHO, which is the same level of someone who just finished internship, is insulting. You have to look at it from that perspective.
Right. So those doctors who accumulate all that debt that they can't afford to pay if they work in the Bahamas, right? They knew it before they left, before they leave. But their high school education, whether they went to private school or not, was subsidized by premium taxpayers, right? But let's not talk about those that crew. Let's talk about the nurses who were trained in the Bahamas. You see?
It's a crying shame to see nurses who, some of them are single mothers, and there's a year and a half after graduating are still being paid a stipend. I don't know how they survive. And then they're offered a job in North Carolina or Atlanta, and I don't blame them for leaving. The system is broken.
So that has to do with all Bahamians who have a livable wage.
I agree. I agree 100%. We can only speak from our perspective. So I'm glad that you're calling in from your perspective. So we're all suffering.
Right. It's wages in the Bahamas is outrageous. And see, what happened is what we do is we do that neo-colonial thing. You see, our neoliberal thing, right? Where we privatize everything and still expect for people who make low wages to be able to make it. You understand what I'm saying?
The
government's not even in place for them. The arguments they make that Santiago said, oh, we need to privatize health. We need to privatize some things, right? But why? Because they say, these people are businessmen and they have experience in running companies. Now, mind you, the same doctors work for them. The only difference is that they are management, right? But the government isn't about making money. You understand? And I'm sure that they provide a service, right? And the government provide a service, right? The doctors that they have to pay, or whoever they have to pay, whether they public or private, who you think is going to pay more? So you understand what I'm saying?
So caller, I get where you're coming from, and I think this is where thinking kind of out of the box comes
into
play.
In other words,
let me finish for you. So this is where the role that governments need to play are doing some of the exact things that they're doing right now. So, for instance, and I agree with you, this is not a living wage, but things that the government can do, the NHI program, for instance,
right,
national health insurance to cover people so that they can get proper care, that's one. The prescription drug plan is actually phenomenal. People are getting their drugs for free. Drugs that cost $500-$600 a month, people are getting those for free. So we've got to find ways to expand those programs so that people who are making minimum wage or anything else like that don't have to worry about their health. So the question is whether health is a basic right.
They're worried about the private insurer. Come on now. But still they want to pay the wage that these people can't pay a private insurer.
Well, let me say, this is one of the more expensive countries in the world to live, top 10. I don't understand how the basic Bahamian makes it. And I always speak about that on the radio, that how does a single mother with 4 kids make it in this society? How do they go to the food store? How do they pay? They can't even even think about getting health insurance. How do they pay their rent? I mean, a typical couple... A middle class, I don't know how they're going to own a home.
Don't provide housing for them.
Exactly.
The two houses, the low-cost houses, they provide, those folks, they know they can't pay the mortgages, they give them to them anyway. And there's only a select group of people.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of problems. People are fighting the fight, and I thank you for your wonderful words. But even in terms of, we have problems with financing healthcare. When we spend $500 million on healthcare, it's the way that we spend the money. I think you need to listen to the people on the ground. The generals need to listen to those in the field. I can name so many ways that money is completely and absolutely wasted. I'll give a common example that I would see every week or every other week. An enlargement of your prostate, whether it's cancerous or benign, is an inevitable part of getting older. So they do it by decades. 50% of 50-year-olds, 60% of 60-year-olds, and probably 70, 80% of 70-year-olds are going to have some element of the obstructing prostate. Many of them are on first-line medical therapy that eventually fails because the medication doesn't stop the prostate from growing, at least most of them don't, and then eventually it reaches a threshold where they may go into urinary retention or they ignore the symptoms. Many behemoth men are very stubborn. They won't say a word for 3 years when they're waking up 10 times in the night to pee, and then one day they can't pee. And whether they're in Rumkey, Cat Island, Long Island, Andros, they're going to go 3 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon to the local clinic where a nurse or a physician is going to try to put a catheter in because they feel like the bladder is going to burst, having the worst pain ever. And because of the mechanics and the physics of it all, they're not going to be able to get a little floppy Foley catheter past that a big obstructing prostate in the front of their outlet of the bladder. And what modern urology has in urology for many years, there are specialized catheters. There are firm silicone catheters with a curved tip that they're engineered to be able to get past that obstructing prostate. It's called a Coudé tip catheter. I've been petitioning for years for the government to buy those. So you would literally see the government spend $5,500 to have somebody air ambulanced in extremist pain because their bladder is about to burst because they cannot urinate. And for the life of me, the common scenario is they're being bolus IV fluids while they're on their ambulance, which makes the problem even 10 times worse. So by the time they're coming, you can know they're there because they're screaming and hollering and about the bladder is about to burst and stretch the capacity. Even when they go to the emergency room, there are none of these Coudé silicone firm catheters or a catheter introducer available that allows us, even a trained urologist with decades of experience, to get in. So I would come out in the middle of the night, bring one of my own personal Coudé catheters, and in 2 seconds put the catheter in, patient is relieved pain, send them back. If we had these catheters in the family islands, we had these catheters in the clinics, we had these catheters in the emergency room, we would be saving 5,000 here, 5,000 here, 5,000 here, 5,000 here, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. We'll talk a little bit more on the other end of the break. This is Urologist Speaks.
Impactful printing services, look no further. Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life. We stand by our quality products that is second to none. Our affordable pricing and friendly, efficient staff makes Printmasters the ultimate choice for all your printing needs. We can deliver any type of printing services, from banners to booklets to business cards. You name it, we can print it.
Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life.
Located in the Nassau Guardian Building, telephone 302-2361.
Wait, why you look so mashed up? Like clothes at the washer?
No, but just a hard day. What?
Hard day? What happened? The breakfast lady ran out of tuna and gritsy.
We need to start joking about everything, you know. This serious, boy. This real serious, boy.
But what's serious? Tell me.
All right, well, today, boss gave us boy one big, big contract. And nobody else get a chance and nobody say nothing.
Boy, you know that ain't right. You know government contracts ain't supposed to go that way.
Yeah, but nobody's saying nothing. Boss man just tell people to sign the papers. Then he sent me to meet his boy downtown and collect this envelope.
You need to tell somebody. You need to become a whistleblower.
You know I's a real man, but I never blow no whistle. I be drunk all my life in Junkano.
No way. A whistleblower is someone who tells people what they see when they see something wrong happening at work.
But I ain't no whistleblower, and I ain't no snitch. I still wait there, you know.
But ain't nobody gonna know it's you. All you gotta do is call Crime Stoppers, or you could text them from inside the Crack Crime Bahamas app. They don't ask about you, and your call goes straight through to Miami, so nobody know you is. And if you text, your message get mixed up like Kong Salad.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Urologist Speaks with BM Urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. My co-host today is Dr. Devon Curling, who's an internist, hematologist, and medical oncologist, cancer expert. So we're going to make use of your expertise, Dr. Curling. Cancer is an overwhelming problem in this country, and that's a sad fact that many of us know. Everybody knows someone who has cancer. It's estimated that one in three women in their lifetime are going to get cancer, and one in four men. For even prostate cancer, one in six are expected to have be afflicted with prostate cancer in their lifetime, and as many as one in eight, one in nine women are going to get breast cancer. So we're overwhelmed, not just with cancers in general, but a more aggressive form of the disease. So while we're making huge strides in medicine in terms of cancer screening and in terms of treatment, wonderful drugs coming out. We've spoken about immunotherapy, but there's a disturbing trend worldwide with the exponential rise in cancer rates in younger adults. In the last three decades, there's been about 80% rise in persons under the age of 40 who are being afflicted with numerous cancers. My question to you as an expert, and I'm sure a lot of the listening audience want to know, why is that? What is the driving trend? What is driving this trend? And we look at our country in particular. We don't have, in looking at us compared to industrialized countries and first world countries, in terms of per capita, we probably smoke less nicotine than anyone. In terms of alcohol, although we consume a lot of alcohol, we consume less alcohol than a generation before us as Bahamians and a generation before that.
It's still a lot.
Yeah, still a lot, but we're drinking less. We don't smoke much. We don't have, in terms of being an industrialized city, in terms of the factories and the environmental pollutants, et cetera, and the toxins. Maybe you can talk about a little bit of that in being happening in Grand Bahama, but per se, we are not that New York where the air pollution level is so high, or Boston, et cetera. So why are our cancer levels spreading at exponential rates, and why particularly in younger persons?
So there's a lot of theories behind that, and you're right. In the Bahamas, we don't have a big smoking population, hence our incidence of lung cancer is fairly low. We know that we have a strong genetic form of breast cancer, also some evidence for colon cancer also. And there have been some anecdotes, like you'll hear some people say that people who are around the military base in Eleuthera have higher rates of cancer, or people in Grand Bahama around the chemical plant and the oil plants, that there's higher incidences of cancer there. We haven't really properly and firmly documented that. There was a group of students, actually, that did a really nice paper about 5 or 6 years ago where they looked and they tried to track cancers by island. That was very interesting. But if we look really into it, and I think if we take a look at what is the main difference between now and 40 years ago, and it's the amount of processed foods that people are eating. Yeah. And, you know,
then we talk about the overuse of antimicrobials in terms of processed foods, in terms of the meats that we consume, yep, from cows to chickens, they're getting antimicrobials in terms of antibiotics. Right. The overuse of antibiotics in general in our society and in throughout the world. I mean, anyone who has a cold, in vast majority of cases, it's viral. They're reaching for their cousins or their mother's Augmentin or amoxicillin. We are indiscriminately using antibiotics, and that's to our detriment. It's affecting our all-important gut microbiome.
Exactly.
And that is also, let's talk about what's affecting the gut microbiome and how is it affecting cancers.
So the gut microbiome is a new field, really. It's what most people don't realize is that your gut may actually control more of what you eat than your brain. And when your gut microbes get exposed to certain foods, they stimulate certain portions of your brain to crave that more. There are going to be good things that you can feed your gut so that you get more of your good bacteria. Those are probiotics and prebiotics and things like that. And once again, getting back to what our food sources are. We know, for instance, you brought up the point with the antibiotics, and our pediatric colleagues are very, very adamant about not giving children antibiotics unless it's needed. And there's been evidence to show that the earlier that a child gets antibiotics, the more problems they have later on in life. I would ask the audience, when they go home, to take a look in their fridge and their cupboards and to see what percentage of their food is actually processed foods. And you'd be shocked. Whereas when I was a child, generally we ate staples. We ate real meat. We ate potatoes. We ate cassavas. We ate fruit that were in season, as opposed to now, where you can literally have a child that does not have a proper meal for an entire week. They're going to McDonald's. They're going to Wendy's. They're getting chips and cookies. And even when you look at the industrialized process of how these foods are made, if you eat a regular fry, a French fry that you cook at home versus one that you get at McDonald's or someplace else, the taste is completely different. It's because there are chemicals and other things like that are placed in it. In addition to the antibiotics, we also have to look at the exposure to hormones, because a lot of these animals are given hormones to stimulate growth. We don't know what that long-term process is and how that affects the human. So we are in a race where we're trying to feed millions and billions of people by any means necessary, and many times there's lots of things that fall through the cracks.
I mean, it's a given that organic is healthier. Organic is better for us. It's going to have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, a lower risk of numerous cancers, but it's more expensive. So we speak about the economics of our country and persons are barely making it. To ask someone to go and spend that money that they don't have to eat organic, because anecdotally, yes, in 20 years it may benefit you health-wise, they're trying to live for the next 20 days. I think we need, the government needs to really promote organic health in terms of organic foods, chickens, cows, whatever we get in our regular meat, not getting any of these hormones, not getting any exposure to pesticides, not getting these antimicrobial therapies, because in the long run, it's going to save us as a nation. We're going to reduce our cancer rates. We're going to reduce our obesity rates. We're going to have a healthier nation. If we can cut down the duty on certain healthier foods, and even making the duty higher on unhealthier foods, we as a nation will live longer, we will live better, we'll have less cancer, we'll have less burden on hospitals and healthcare system as a whole, and we'll have more of our grandparents living and our parents living longer. We'll have less problems with our children getting illnesses at younger ages. I think that is something that we fundamentally need to address, and I think it can turn things around very quickly, immediately, and even for the next generation. And that goes without saying. So when we talk about cancer, we're not going to assume everybody knows what cancer. So cancer is both a genetic and metabolic disease. And we talk about what drives cancer, what causes cancer. Cancer is essentially the unregulated cell growth or dysregulated cell growth. So cells that grow without responding to normal cell growth signaling. So there's also a strong immune response related to cancer. So in the last 20 years or more, we talk about the use of immunotherapy. Please, let's talk about immunotherapy, because I've said it many times, and I, in my personal experience, have seen immunotherapy do wonders. Someone who would have died from metastatic disease, whether it's bladder or kidney or colon, are living a decade, 15 years because of immunotherapy. We do imaging and all of the metastatic disease to their lungs, to the liver, has basically disappeared. What is immunotherapy? It is a readily available in the Bahamas. What exactly is immunotherapy?
So what the immunotherapeutic agents do is they actually stimulate your body's own immune system to go after these cells that are misbehaving, okay? So now when you look at it, it's a part of a new wave of what we call targeted therapies. So when I first finished many years ago, everybody got chemo. Chemo is essentially a shotgun. It's a shotgun with bird pellet. I take it out, I fire, and I hit good cells, bad cells, and that's why people get the side effects that they get. They get the nausea, they get the vomiting and other things like that, even though we're doing a lot better at controlling those. With the targeted therapies and the immunotherapies, what we're now doing is we're in the new era of personalized medicine. And what we're now finding is that no cancer is actually the same. So, for instance, people think of breast cancer as one disease, but it's not. There's hormone receptor positive, there's HER2 negative, there's breast cancers with NTRK mutations, there's tons of different mutations that cause these things. And what we're now doing is we're actually finding a target and making a drug that specifically targets a marker that is only on that cancer cell. Hence, we're becoming a lot more specific in terms of what we do. The issues with that, of course, here is that these new personalized medicines cost a lot more. But we are seeing people live for years. I have patients who are on these targeted therapies where, had they been diagnosed 15 years ago, they would have literally been dead in 2 years. And now they're still going to work, traveling with their families, doing everything for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. And nobody knows. Each day, we're getting better and better at finding more and more targets that we can actually act on. So what happens is we treat somebody. We find that, let's say in lung cancer, somebody has something called an ALK mutation. So we start them on ALK-based therapy. First line, they get resistant to that. We try another one, they get resistant to that. Then we can actually repeat our testing, and you mentioned this before, we can actually, using blood, we can actually repeat our testing and see if there's any new mutations that the person has developed over time that we can now go ahead and target.
And even in terms of radiation, which is also very important, there's a lot of, in terms of just image-guided, direct radiation to only that area, sparing the surrounding structures. 30, 40 years ago, that was not the case. Yep. The entire area was bombarded with radiation. In fact, the levels of radiation have actually decreased as well. And you would have persons with secondary malignancies. You'd have issues where you have radiation, for example, even prostate cancer of your bladder, of your rectum, having issues because of that as well, having bowel symptoms because of it. Now, cancer treatment has gone by leaps and bounds, and it continues all the time. We always talk about why there's so much in the way of cancer in our society. We talk about the genetics, the genetic mutations. But per se, we talk about germline mutation. We talk about somatic mutations. So in genetic testing, you're looking for germline mutations. You're looking at genes that are inherited. But the test involves looking at genetic sequencing. The problem is that the vast majority, I would say 95%, are actually related to not inherited germline mutations, but actually somatic mutations. So we have to understand the difference. And when we blame it, oh, it's all in the genes, that actually is not the case. When we talk about somatic mutations that are driving most of these cancers, these are not actually inherited at all. A lot of it is related to environmental factors. When we talk about modifiable risk factors, non-modifiable risk factors, one of the big risk factors for our society as a whole is obesity. And that plays a role in terms of for postmenopausal women having a greater risk of having numerous gynecological cancers, including getting breast cancer as well. So we as a nation need to get healthier. We need to combat obesity for so many reasons. We always talk about the overwhelming number of non-communicable diseases and hypertension and cardiovascular disease. It's bringing our nation to its knees. The health of the nation is the wealth of the nation, and we're dying and we're poor because of it. We have another call coming in. This is Urologist Speaks. Good evening.
Hello.
Good day. Good day.
Good evening, Dr. Pinto, and to your guest.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah. Great show. I was listening. And the thing is, Dr. Pinto, your last narrative is really what I was calling about as it relates to the mutations of these oncogenes, et cetera, right? And so what happened is, the problem is with these oncogenes, right? Is you said be looking at, well, I don't know if they have any meta-analysis. You're looking at let's say you say the mutations, right, and the external factors like environmental factors, et cetera. And so, prevention, I'm big on prevention, right, because, it's a duty of care to educate the public, and as a doc, you should be able to simplify it. I think the doc explains it well, as it relates to the immune system. But the thing is, with the oncogenes being the genes that control cell growth, and so if they get out of whack, the question for me, intuitively, I don't need to be as knowledgeable about the molecular events as any doctor. I could just say, well, what is causing this? It has to be some external factors. So I'm saying is, I suppose the question I'd like you guys to answer, but I don't think this would be you, Dr. Pinto. Do doctors feel some way when a patient questions them or critique them in a way? That's what I'm saying. Are doctors too haughty to be critiqued by a non-pundit in a factual way, like just common sense? Like, we're talking about cancer now, right? And one of the things I hate is not being forthwith with the percentage of cancer that is caused by hereditary, right? You know what I mean? Being inherited through a gene dysfunction or whatever. And that is very low. And so then we would look at external factors, environmental factors.
Well, I mean, that's good news because that's something that we can change.
Causing these things to go out of whack. And then we look at the proliferation of just basically the healthcare industry, big pharma, et cetera, concentrating on just medicine and vaccinations. And so there's vaccinations for everything. And then truthfully and factually and intellectually, being intellectually honest, when you go online and you look at the side effects, they hide some of these. And so, the data is able to be suppressed because of their influence, and this is well known, and it's like, of course they have peer-reviewed studies, et cetera, but we saw, all right, like for instance, oh yes, it's the new vaccine you was talking about the other day. I don't know if it's you, Dr. Pinto, but they were talking about the HPV, but it was some, or maybe I could be incorrect, but it was in a vaccine, but I remember just very specifically because it was on Guardian News over the holidays, when they had it on, it was saying that the efficacy rate was 80% or et cetera, et cetera. And, but this particular disease, it is worth still dispensing it at 30%, versus the FDA requirements requires a threshold of about 50%. So the public's, the medical industry and science is so large, it is so broad, you guys have to continue doing what you're doing, and that's what I'm saying. You just, and prevention, I'm big on prevention, because you're talking about the crisis within the healthcare industry, right, Doc? And that's what frightens me, and the drained brain. And that's what frightens me, because I have a lot of family members that didn't come back also. You see what I'm saying? So I want you guys to keep it up. You have to educate the public. The public also, just like economics, the public likewise has to be educated about the science behind what is causing this, all of these, the proliferation of these non-contagious diseases, et cetera, et cetera. And we just a sitting duck. And so just one question, final question for the doctor. So, Doc, in immunotherapy, and just a basic question that I need to know, because, when they tell me I have cancer now, I don't know what I can do. But because the body is unable to kill the cancer cells without, some form of other intervention, right, does that cause T-cell exhaustion or immune cell exhaustion? I'll hang up and listen.
Caller, that's a good question. Now, does immunotherapy cause a T-cell exhaustion? And honestly, that's something that I'd have to get back to you on. I'm not sure as to how to answer that. We know that we develop little tiny cancers in our body every day. But for the most part, our surveillance system is able to attack it and to take care of it. The cancer cell that we see that's growing all over the place, that's one that has evaded that system. And cancer cells are very good at adapting new mutations each time that they divide to further evade so that they can grow. But in terms of specific effects on the T cell populations themselves with the immunotherapy, I am more than happy to look that up and to get back to you on that.
You made a lot of great points. I think the most important thing is that the vast majority of cancers are influenced by modifiable risk factors. So we have the control over our own destiny in the vast majority of cases. Obviously, some people are handed an unfair deck and the deck is stacked against them. And for one reason or the other, they may be predisposed to get colon cancer at a high incidence or high likelihood by the time they're 35. But for the society as a whole, we have within our own hands the ability to dictate whether we're going to get cancer at any decade in our life. So the two most important factors influencing somatic mutations, which influence most cancers, the vast majority of cancers, only maybe is 95%, is cigarette smoking, which is, everybody knows that. And it's not just, we're talking about lung cancer. I mean, there's so many persons that get small cell lung cancer that never smoked in their life, never were exposed to smoking, never had secondhand smoke or worked in an environment rich in toxins or environment pollutants. So sometimes genetics play a role, but obesity is the second most important influence in terms of somatic mutations for innumerable number of cancers. So we're not talking about obesity per se and influencing cancer risk, but we're talking about insulin resistance and increased inflammation associated with obesity. So we as a nation can get healthy. We can reduce our risk of getting cancers. I've spoken about this many times, and this is verifiable truth. In fact, the Surgeon General in January of this year wanted to put warning labels on alcohol, all types of alcohol. Obviously, he's going to get a lot of backlash from the capitalist system where alcohol endorses everything and runs everything. It's a big money maker, billion-dollar business. Cancer, at least six different cancers, including breast cancer, are strongly influenced by even moderate alcohol intake. Now, I'm talking about excess alcohol intake. So if you can cut out alcohol altogether as a woman in this behemoth society or drink rarely, sparingly, you can reduce your chance of getting breast cancer by as much as 15%. That's considerable. So things that we can do, particularly as a postmenopausal woman, you need to stay active for your mind, for your health, for your longevity, and you need to make sure that you have a normal body mass index and that you're not obese or overweight, because that you're just putting yourself, priming yourself to get a cancer. Let's switch to something a little bit more pleasant. Well, I won't say pleasant. Let's switch the topic. Let me make use of you as a hematologist. We have an overwhelming problem in this society as a predominantly black society in terms of sickle cell disease. Sickle cell disease, if you work in the hospitals, you'll see persons of all ages, whether they're 11 years old or 17 years old or 27 years old, coming in because of sickling crisis and extremist pain. As urologists, getting referred all the time, every week, persons at Princess Margaret Hospital coming in with priapism, which is an unintentional erection lasting more than 4 hours. And that can be devastating. If you have an erection and you're a sickler, please, you must get to a urologist. You must get to the emergency room immediately, because beyond 4 hours, beyond 6 hours, definitely going into 8 hours, you can have ischemic changes to your penis, irreversible damage to your penis. And I've seen far too many 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, just with a spontaneous erection, never able to have an erection again because they waited a whole day with priapism and a sustained erection. Talk to us a little about sickle cell. Let's talk about testing for sickle cell. Do you think that someone who has sickle cell, they should have testing of their partner before they get married? Should they have some kind of medical intervention in terms of, okay, you both have sickle cell, maybe you should adopt because of the devastation of sickle cell? Or do you think sickle cell is not as big a problem as I'm leading it to be?
No, I mean, sickle cell is definitely an issue here. So when we look at sickle cell, there's sickle cell disease, which is where you have two sickle genes, and then there's sickle cell trait, where you have a normal gene and you have one sickle gene. When you have sickle cell trait, it really doesn't affect your life that much, unless you get really ill, that can cause you to go into a crisis. But for the most part, people with sickle cell trait live a relatively normal life. Now, someone with sickle cell disease itself, and this is where we get into the painful crises and the other complications that can occur with that, gallstones and so on, infections, strokes. So it is a very severe and debilitating disease. And the part that you mentioned in terms of counseling. So if you have sickle trait, if you are going to get married or have a partner, someone with someone who's normal, then 50% of your children will be sickle trait and 50% will be normal. If you are a sickle trait person who's getting married or partnering with another sickle trait, 1 in 4 of your children will have sickle cell disease, 1 in 4 of your children will be normal, 2 in 4 will have trait. Obviously, if you are a sickle trait person and you marry someone with SS disease, meaning full-blown sickle cell, then half of your children will have trait, half of your children will have full-blown sickle cell disease.
And so, that's just statistically speaking. I mean, there are some people who are, unfortunately, all 4 kids are going to have sickle cell disease.
Yes. So one of the things that I always tell my sickle patients is, yes, if you are seriously involved with somebody, before you even get there, the first question that you should ask is, hey, what is your status? I have sickle trait or I have sickle cell disease. If you're thinking about getting serious, okay? It does affect your ability to get pregnant sometimes. So the pregnancy complications in someone with sickle cell disease goes up significantly. There's high rates of pregnancy losses. And there's high morbidity in terms of damage to the mother. So these are all things that we have to kind of take a look at. And as you mentioned, do we want to adopt? Yes, doc, I understand that, but this is who I want to be with, and we want to move on. There are now some new therapies out. There's gene therapies that are coming out now where we can actually cure it. Unfortunately, those gene therapies right now are in the neighborhood of $2 or $3 million. But at least we now have something that's in the pipeline that will over time hopefully come down in cost and be reasonable and be an option for some people to have. Sickle cell, the degree and severity of it varies from person to person. There are some sicklers who walk around, never have a crisis in their life, and they do fine. There are others who don't make it out of childhood because of strokes and other things like that. So when you're making the decision, knowing what your status is becomes very important.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen 18-year-olds are hemiplegic because of a stroke from sickle cell. I've seen 11-year-olds because of priapism and sustained erection for a day never get an erection again in their lifetime. So what is their outlook in terms of having a child naturally or having a partner again? It can be very devastating.
Right.
Thank you very much for coming, Dr. Curling. Where can patients or the public reach out to you and see you as either hematologist or oncologist?
Okay, so I'm at the clinic at Princess Margaret Hospital, and privately I'm at Oncology Consultants, which is on Nassau Street. But I just like to close out by saying, and this is in reference to the previous caller, we're an unhealthy nation and we need to move. So whatever you do throughout your day, apart from eating right, also engage in movement. We are a very sedentary nation. We sit down, we eat our food, we sit at the computer all day. Simple adjustments like getting a stand-up desk where you have to stand up to do your notes and so on. These things make a difference.
Thank you. You're always welcome. You have an open door policy here for you and Dr. Francis, and maybe one day you'll actually be the host and give me a break. But have a good evening and have a safe week, Bahamas. Thank you. This is Urologist Speaks. Urologist Speaks.
losing grip of your mind. Don't give up on hope.
Don't be ashamed. It's time to take control. Get some help from the urologist.
You will find
he'll help you solve your problems on 96.9.